Oh, no, it was, this is all your stuff.
Yeah.
Do you want it? Well, there are so many groups that have been using it, but, you know, look at this.
I guess so.
Get rid of it. I'm just going to take it. But by the time they call somebody, the meeting's going to start. What about this? This just looks awful.
I have no idea.
I'm going to just take it. I'll put these books on the side there in case somebody, I don't know, UN Development Program. It just looks so messy. Well,
oh,
the front
good
is,
enough.
But I'll get another one. Should I take this too? It's UNDP.
Oh, and that, oh gosh,
they were
I don't know. It's UNDP, yeah.
I'll just put the, I'll leave those things out there.
Okay. La visera.
Thank you. In fact, I'm so sorry I wasn't able to come because I had another meeting. No, I was waiting for you.
I'm sorry for a moment.
Yeah.
I was going to call upon you and I was going to be here.
Because I had another meeting. No, but you have lots of speakers out of the meeting. What is it that I can say that will make a difference? You know, I mean, these are all very interesting contributions. So congratulations. Very good, I thought. My own time. That's just how I have my colleagues have printed out. And I write my name first. Yeah. And then the other thing about this friend of yours. Yeah, really.
them. Can we ask everybody to take their seats now so we can start? Because we need to get the responses and then also open the floor to the participants who want to ask a question. The 11th meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, this afternoon we shall still continue our discussion under item 6 of the agenda. As part of the in-depth comprehensive dialogue with the agencies, bodies, and funds, we will continue our panel with the International Fund for Agricultural Development, which started this morning's meeting. Mr. Jean-Philippe Audinet, the Director for Policy Division, IFAD, and Antonella Cordone and Zenia, who are the members of his team, are with me in the podium to make comments and answer questions from the participants. So I would like now to give the floor to them to respond to the many, many questions raised by my dear colleagues earlier. But as I said, you know, we don't have all the time, so you can have the liberty to choose what you think is most important, and then later on we can continue the conversations. But we would like to make sure that we have some time also for for the government and the indigenous participants to also raise their questions, and maybe also from the other colleagues. So I'm give you back the floor, Mr. Jean-Philippe.
Thank you, Vicky. Indeed, the questions were many and were complex and difficult questions. So please forgive us if we don't answer to all. We have actually written elements that we will share with the member of the forum regarding all the questions after. But here I will select only a few. And then we start by the first one, which was, how does IFAD perceive the impact of the declaration in its activities and overall direction? Well, on these questions, I think we have to look at two different levels. One level is the impact of the declaration in our activity at country level. And on this, it depends very much from a country to another, depending on the attitude of both the government and also indigenous people's movement and civil societies on the way in country they use or don't use the declaration. Our impression is that selecting indigenous peoples as a specific and explicit target group, for example, in our country strategy paper, our COSOP, is now easier because the fact that the declaration exists makes this concept and this reality more, in a way, legitimate for an open dialogue. But the other thing which is very important for us is to which extent the declaration has and is influencing our corporate policy. And on this, it's very clear that the policies I was speaking about this morning, that is currently under development, that already went through a first informal discussion with our board of directors, is basically inspired by the declaration. I hope you will be able to see this approved policy document in September, and you will see that although we are not continuously referring to it, actually in the substance, it's extremely influenced by that. However, and to tell the full picture, the fact that some important countries, member of IFAD, have not approved this declaration is, to a certain extent, an obstacle to a full recognition of this document as a guiding document for IFAD in our executive board. And from this point of view, we hope that other countries will do what Australia has been doing recently, is to change its mind and indeed approve the declaration, because having a consensus will help actually being able to use this document as a policy guidance document within an institution as IFAD. The second question, referring also to the declaration, particularly to the Article 42, does IFAD intend to collaborate with the UN Permanent Forum, and how in ensuring the implementation of the declaration, and especially Article 42? On this, well, my first response is the same as before. Yes, we are, through this new policy, under preparation, indeed engaging in implementing the declaration in the context of IFAD, taking consideration that IFAD is not a normative institution, it's a fund with its own policy, but by introducing within our policy some of the basic principles that are in the declaration, we actually internalize this declaration in our own corporate policy. I remind also that we've done it already in another policy I was referring to this morning, which is our policy on access to land, where the principle of free, prior, and informed consent is already inside and approved. I would like also to refer to another guidance document, which is not a policy but more operational guidelines. We call it our environmental and social assessment procedures. And on this, there are a number, I will not go into details, but a number of specific guidelines that are referring to the rights of indigenous peoples. So, the process of how the declaration will impact on the activity of IFAD, I repeat, a part of it will go through the way it impacts on the countries, and another part is going through the development adoption of this new corporate policy. I will. There was a specific question, again, regarding this policy. At what stage is the development of IFAD's own principle of engagement / policies with indigenous peoples? So I repeat, this has been developed through a long process, actually, of consultation with a number of indigenous peoples' leaders, with other institutions, including the member of the interagency support group. It has been presented with a very positive discussion in our informal seminar with the board in April. There was, from this discussion, no major opposition, and a number of countries that were very actively supporting this draft document. They made some comments. We are now integrating these comments. We are also receiving comments from the forum itself, from other sister agencies. They will be integrated, and finally, by the end of this month, basically, in June, we will have a final document that will go to the September board. Obviously, we hope that it will be approved in September. This will depend on our member countries, but we are confident that it should be done in September. And it will be something important for us, because it will be the formalization and the recognition of a certain type of engagement with indigenous peoples that is very much at the heart of the specificity of our institution. There was a number of questions regarding the COSOP, our country strategy paper. On this one, I will ask Antonella to respond to one of them. These are very detailed questions, and the response could be very long. So I will ask Antonella to respond specifically on the third question regarding the COSOP, and in particular regarding the specific case of Honduras, Panama, Belize, Mexico, Bolivia, Brazil, and Guatemala.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean-Philippe. Ms. Chair, thank you. Yes, on the COSOP, the ones we were referring specifically were the ones approved for Latin America division, which pay particular in 2007, which pay particular attention to indigenous peoples. And I want to be telegraphic and provide you with two examples. One is Honduras, that stresses the importance of paying more attention to the needs of rural women and indigenous groups. And Also how the process was designed, the COSOPs, with consultations which were conducted with small-scale farmers, women, and indigenous people's leaders. The other one is Guatemala, and this COSOP is very important for indigenous peoples because it stresses the need to affirm the multicultural and multilingual identity of the country's indigenous peoples through active involvement of indigenous staff and use of indigenous languages in program activities. This COSOP is quite well advanced, and a positive aspect relates to the fact that COSOP addresses the need to affirm the multicultural and multilingual identity, and also what the forum and the ISG has been calling for, the active involvement of indigenous staff at project level when projects are implemented. I'll pass the floor back to you, Jean-Philippe.
Yes, let me now briefly respond to the question regarding the free, prior, and informed consent. How does the organization secure the implementation of this principle with partners on national as on local level? Well, the answer to this has very much to do with how IFAD-funded projects are designed, okay? And I would like to just remind that in 2005 we had a workshop called Indigenous and Tribal People's Perspective on Selected IFAD-Funded Projects. And one of the conclusions of the workshop was, and I quote, whenever IFAD-funded projects are promoting the full and effective participation of the community in planning and implementation, it is in practice applying the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. And indeed, the very way most of our projects, not all, but most of the projects we support are designed, made that not only there is an idea that is submitted then to a consent, but the very idea of the project, its objective, its implementation approach, sometimes even the selection of the operational partners, is done with and by the communities that will be involved in the project. And therefore, from this point of view, as you know, IFAD is not very much involved in, for example, big infrastructure development or this type of things. It's very much community-driven development approach that we have. From this point of view, the consent is built by the involvement of communities at local level in the design of the project. Now, this is, I would say, the model, and this is, you will see it, in our policy. However, things are not so simple, because sometimes within specific areas, there are actually different local communities that may have different interests and views. Typically, in the Sahel or Eastern Africa, you will have pastoralist communities and sedentary farmers' communities that may have, both indigenous, that may have different views and interest in how to manage common property resources. In this type of things, beyond the involvement of people in the project, what has to be built are ways of negotiating between communities, and obviously between communities and the state and the government, in order to ensure that the interest and the rights of the different components of the rural communities are not only taken into account at design, but very much kept within and all along the implementation of the project. And this is something extremely important and which is part very much of the quality of the design of the project we try to achieve. Basically, the way we try to describe this is that it's not IFAD that asks the participation of people, but we try to participate in the project of people in terms of serving what is their own views of their development. I will not answer the question regarding the microcredit because In most, we do a lot of microfinance in our portfolio. In most of the case, almost all, we do not require collaterals to get access to credit. So therefore, there is no issue of land or private land ownership.
Can I?
Yeah.
Jean-Philippe,
Should I stop?
No, I will request you to just hold on to the answers because there might be questions which are similar from governments and
okay.
from indigenous people. So I will just ask them to state their questions and then we'll go back to you
okay.
again. And you okay. can continue with the part where you left off, okay? So I have now on my list some governments and indigenous representatives would like to ask questions. So I'd first ask one government to ask and then I'll move to the indigenous. So I'd like to ask the representative of the observer state of Denmark, Mr. Andreas Balzer Jorgensen, to ask his questions. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. IFAD should be complemented with success in strengthening its engagement with indigenous peoples and the emerging policy on engagement with indigenous peoples. IFAD should also be complemented with its wide range of projects addressing issues of crucial importance for indigenous peoples. It should finally be credited for its studies in the Latin American and Caribbean region and in the Asian region, which will provide recommendations for further strengthening of this work. Will IFAD also undertake such a study in Africa as it seems to be needed? As I read the report, it's giving slightly contradictory information on the use of guidelines in applying indigenous issues in all IFAD's relevant projects and programs. In some sections of the report, it seems that the organization is satisfied with UNDG guidelines on indigenous people's issues. In other places, it's said that IFAD will translate the main principles of the declaration into operational guidelines at regional and sub-regional levels. Will IFAD find the UNDG sufficient at the country level, or will IFAD develop specific operational guidelines based on the declaration on regional and sub-regional level? Compared to most other agencies, a large percentage of the total lending program, 22% we were told in the report, and today we were informed that it's 30%, is benefiting indigenous peoples. It appears that a large amount is given in Latin America, some is given in Asia, and less in Africa. Will IFAD in the future give more support to indigenous peoples in Africa? The close engagement with indigenous peoples are through microgrants, which last for only 1 year. 1 year seems a very short period. Are there any plans to let the grants cover more than 1 year so you can develop closer partnerships? As IFAD is undertaking many activities with indigenous peoples, both a small microproject and its mainstream programs and projects, it would be good to learn from their difficulties and limitations. However, little is said on limitations in the report. What is mentioned is that mainstreaming is somehow a problem, that is, there is a need for more systematic approach to all programs and projects where indigenous peoples are found. IFAD writes in the report that it will be ensured by the new policy on engagements with indigenous peoples, but I guess that something more concrete will be needed. I could mention four aspects which can be important in implementing improved strategies for indigenous peoples. One is the capacity building of IFAD staff. Second is to choose consultants in its mainstream work which are conversant with indigenous issues. Three, the employment of indigenous consultants. And finally, the check on the sensitivity on indigenous issues on the agencies and organizations which are implementing the large projects and programs. Is IFAD planning such activities? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jorgensen, for those questions. I'd like now to call on the representative of the Asian Indigenous Peoples Caucus, Jennifer Corpus. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to participate in the dialogue with IFAD. Indigenous peoples in Asia welcome the efforts of IFAD in coming up with its policy of engagement with indigenous peoples. This is very timely in view of the adoption of the UN DRIP. The draft policy has been drafted in close consultation with indigenous peoples, and we are happy to note that many of our suggestions were taken up in the draft policy. We commend IFAD for the provision in the draft policy committing to adhere to the principle of free, prior, and informed consent, and hope that the final policy retains this commitment. We note, however, that the draft policy contains no complaint procedure in cases where the policy is not observed, nor any provision on means for redress for damage caused to Indigenous peoples in instances where the policy is not observed. Also, the policy does not mention any type of independent monitoring mechanism for the implementation of the policy. Indigenous peoples have been adversely affected by culturally inappropriate agriculture projects that have that IFAD has been supporting in Indigenous peoples' territories. We note that this shortcoming has been duly recognized in the draft policy and addressed also, and we look forward to the implementation of the community-driven development model contained in the policy. We put forth the following questions. Can we expect IFAD to speedily adopt the policy, ensuring that the provision on adherence to FPIC is retained and strengthened? Next, what is the possibility of IFAD establishing an independent monitoring mechanism in relation to the implementation of its Indigenous Peoples Policy? We were asked to ask questions, but we also would strongly recommend the establishment of such a body as soon as the policy is approved. Next question is, can IFAD consider the establishment of a complaint mechanism to address cases where the policy is not observed in IFAD projects, as well as means for redress where damage has been caused? We likewise strongly recommend the establishment of these mechanisms. Can IFAD ensure that all its programs are consistent with the UNDRIP, UNDRIP, and that there is high awareness among its staff at all levels of the UNDRIP? And finally, how does IFAD ensure sustainable development of Indigenous peoples, especially in areas where IFAD-funded projects are introducing high-value crops, which results in the loss of traditional seed and crop varieties, introducing chemical-based agricultural inputs, which causes health problems, depletion of soil fertility, and marginalization of traditional indigenous farming systems, which are also organic farming systems, and replacing indigenous collective natural resource management and reinforcing individual or private resource use that is unsustainable and causing changes in land use and management. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Those who are asking questions, if there are lots of them, please make sure that you bring a copy to the party, to the IFAD panel here, so that they will have a chance to read the questions in more carefully. I would like now to call on the representative of the observer state of Mexico, Mr. Enrique Ochoa. You have the floor, sir.
Señora Presidente.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My delegation wishes to thank everyone and the agencies of the United Nations system for all the information they have provided over the span of these few days and for the reports they have submitted under this agenda item. Mexico broadly supports the programs which promote the well-being and improvement in living conditions of indigenous peoples. These are activities carried out by various agencies of the United Nations. My delegation wishes to emphasize the importance of the UNITAR program in the area of training on negotiation, those based on rights as well as those based on problem solving, in order to resolve conflicts in a mutually beneficial and sustainable manner. Mexico believes that this program offers indigenous peoples and governments basic tools with which to resolve pending issues, and this is the goal of the second international decade. We also note that this year, The report of the United Nations Population Fund has attached great importance to intercultural reproductive health services, as well as to measures aimed at promoting gender equality and the empowerment of indigenous women, as well as their organizations. In order to contribute to improving the status of the health of indigenous women through interinstitutional links to promote development and strengthening of their capacities, as well as those of the health personnel delivering services in rural and indigenous communities, the government of Mexico in 2008 launched a campaign to promote the comprehensive health of indigenous women. For Mexico, it is very important to achieve equality between men and women, as well as to prevent, punish, and eradicate violence against women, and in particular against indigenous women. Thus, we have approved a general law on equality between men and women and a general law on access of women by women to a life free from violence. Mexico has adopted affirmative action so that indigenous women and girls will have scholarships and support funds to guarantee equality and access to all kinds and educational levels, also to ensure the participation of indigenous women in the formulation of programs and actions aimed at improving living conditions in their communities and spreading in indigenous communities information about reproductive and sexual rights of women, as well as to men, so that men and the communities as a whole are aware of their observance and exercise. We also promote the empowerment of women and their participation and representation in decision-making spaces at the state level, as well as to consolidate a democratic culture. One of the obstacles is the fact that indigenous women do not participate in decision-making. We therefore promote the participation of indigenous women at all levels, including the permanent forum, and we would like to suggest that this body open up a space in which indigenous women may express their views about the uses and customs which could affect the enjoyment of their human rights. Finally, Madam Chair, I'd like to say that the Center of Studies for the Advancement of Women and Gender Equality of our Chamber of Deputies has prepared a study on the legislative needs to have access to regulating domestic work, the purpose of which is to prepare proposals to improve the labor conditions of domestic workers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like now to call on the representative of the Confederación de Pueblos Indígenas de Bolivia, Elias Kelka. I think he left already, no? So he's not here. Okay, I call on Ariel Yanes, who is speaking on behalf of the Confederación Sindical de Comunidades Interculturales de Bolivia. Is Ariel Yanes in the room? Nope. Okay, I'll call now on the representative of the observer state of Norway, Mr. Lars Sigurd Valvatne, the senior advisor of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to thank IFAD for their comprehensive report and for their oral presentation here today. As you have stated, you are now working under the IFAD strategic framework for a period of 2007 to 2010, where indigenous peoples are singled out as one of the fund's principal target groups as regard poverty alleviation. The period of the present strategic framework is now nearing its end. I would then like to ask you if it would be possible for you to elaborate a bit or disclose a bit on your discussions on the next policy framework as regards the work on indigenous peoples. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the person I called earlier is here. Is Ariel Yanes in the room? Yes, you have the floor, sir. Is that him? Okay. You raise your hands. And, yeah.
Bien, principio saludar a...
First of all, I wish to greet all my brothers and from various countries, as well as from the indigenous peoples. I am Ariel Yáñez, and I come from the Confederación Sindical of Intercultural Communities of Bolivia. We have come here on behalf of the Pact of Unity and also on behalf of the National Council for Change in Bolivia. I would like to refer... Well, we have been... discussing this during the break, I'd like to refer to the fact that IFAD in some way would work with organizations of indigenous peoples, in our case, in the Latin American region and in particular in Bolivia. I would like to state emphatically that we would like this fund to be able to work in an organic and effective manner with our organizations and mainly with those of us who promote family economics, small producers. And so far, we have not seen clearly how the matter of the production of biofuels or agrofuels is being approached. This, as we know, represents a risk for all peoples and also for indigenous peoples because they endanger our traditional seeds. And that is what we would like to ask about. How are you working on this so that it will not be possible to promote agrofuels? We see a risk not only to health, but also food may become scarce in the world, and we will not be able to have food sovereignty, which we are promoting. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ariel Yáñez. And the last person on my list is Mario Flores from Habitat Pro Association. You have the floor, sir.
Señora Presidenta.
Madam Chair, my name is Mario Flores. Distinguished brothers and sisters from all over the world, I greet each and every one of you from the indigenous community Aymara of Condoiri Ayulo Copiasa of the Carangas province, Corque Oruro, Bolivia. I am here for the first time and I wish to share the following with you. Our Aymara indigenous community, as an Aymara social identity in Bolivia, presents all the forms in which dominant groups have named original peoples in this country. Beginning with the decade of the 70s, we forged the Aymara identity as a political, economic, and cultural identity. Today, it brings together in a pluricultural nation all of its peoples, which used to be termed Indians or peasants in the past. We have not been taken into account as persons, whereas locally they were used to carry out projects. Our Aymara indigenous identity today is indeed a community in Condoriri. At this forum, I have been listening, and I suggest, as an Aymara indigenous person, I suggest that the permanent forum should work together with indigenous communities without imposing anything. We must have a macro regional development plan for every indigenous community, together with institutions which work toward the development of our communities. We must be partners. We must be transparent. Indigenous community, government, NGOs, and the various nations. I therefore suggest that we reduce the percentages and of mother-child mortality and sexually transmitted diseases. We must build health centers in indigenous communities, reduce poverty and marginalization, which have a strong impact on public health, basically on girls and boys under five, as well as older men and women. We must improve this.
I would like you to please ask your question from our panelists so that they can respond to whatever questions you like to ask.
Está bien, muchas gracias.
All right, thank you very much. My question is, when will indigenous communities be taken into account in these development projects? We know very well that NGOs and various institutions are working, but in fact, we do not see what they are doing. Thank you very much.
Very much, Mr. The representative of Habitat Pro Association. I would like to call on my colleagues now to also briefly ask some questions. We have a few minutes left for them to respond, so please try to be very brief. Mr. Belkasam and then Ms. Molo.
Shukran, Sayyidat Ra'isa. Awaddu bidayatan an ashkura al-Sayyid John wa Sayyid Antonio.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to thank the representatives of IFAD and the entire IFAD team that has come to this meeting. I believe that it is very important to say that IFAD plays a crucial role in its relations with indigenous peoples. Nevertheless, that role is linked to action toward reducing poverty among indigenous communities. We often speak about the fact that indigenous peoples are poor. That is true. But that poverty exists although the indigenous people have very rich soils and lands which have been made, impoverished through a number of decisions. Therefore, in the framework of cooperation between FAO and IFAD, and on the basis of principles which have been explained by FAO, we can say that agriculture encompasses all activities relating to nature, and therefore it would be possible to reduce poverty, provided that international institutions contribute and participate in partnerships. If we take into account the problems of indigenous peoples and the gamut of activities, we know that poverty will be reduced through partnerships nationally and internationally to recognize the rights of indigenous peoples and their rights to their land and resources. This will also make it possible to recognize how crucial authority and resources are. And here I have a question. Perhaps you've said that, I think you said that 20% of is allocated through governments, through the indigenous populations. 80% goes to governments. I think that is what you said. But I would like to know whether through your projects and through your project assessment, you control or you monitor what is taking place on the lands of indigenous populations to which you devote 20%. And if the projects that are carried out under the 80% that goes to the governments does not really satisfy the indigenous peoples. I would like to know whether you monitor and evaluate these lessons learned. Also, do you work directly with the indigenous peoples? And with small enterprises, is it possible to increase that budget after the proclamation of the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples? Is it possible to open this field up to cooperation? Considering and on the in the period following the declaration. Thank you.
And you can respond again to some questions, not necessarily to all. So I give you the floor. Well, we have, I can extend a little bit until for 15 minutes, but we need to also have some closing remarks from our colleagues. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for all these questions because they are all very relevant and they will help us in improving our work. Obviously, it's very difficult to answer and to have a dialogue with all of you in such a limited period of time, and actually we will have to find ways to speak to each other more and with more time. I will try briefly to answer to some of the questions, starting with a question from Denmark. Which was about an issue that was raised also by our questions from the forum itself, and which is the share of our investment going to indigenous peoples in Africa. It appears indeed in our report that in Africa the percentage of our investment going to indigenous people seems to be much smaller in relative terms than what we do in Latin America or even in Asia. And here I think there is a part of, there is a part that comes from a strategy that very explicitly in Asia and certainly in Latin America, there has been a strategic choice because poverty is extremely concentrated among indigenous peoples, to consider indigenous peoples in these two continents not only as a specific target group within our overall target group, but as a priority target group. This is one part of the answer. The second part of the answer is that in Africa, as you know very well, the self-identification as indigenous peoples or the process of self-identification as indigenous people is still ongoing. There are many communities that don't use this term. There are even communities that don't want to use this term because it is potentially creating conflicts. So, in a continent, I'm talking in particular of sub-Saharan Africa, where rural poverty is widespread, the current societies and communities that identify themselves as indigenous peoples are mostly pastoralists, hunter-gatherers, forest dwellers. And so far, but I think it will change, many of the sedentary farmers' communities have not yet adopted this concept and this language. So this is the second part of the answer, is that when you say, I have 30% of my investment with indigenous peoples, we say, with indigenous peoples that self-identify themselves as such. So this may change in the future. Regarding the big picture, I just want to remind you that IFAD is putting between 40 and 50% of its investment in Africa. So we have certainly a very strong focus in Africa because Africa is where we have the biggest concentration of poverty. There was a question about this very, indeed, short-term, one-year small grants. provided by the IPAF facility. Let's remember that this, first of all, there are two questions answered to this question. First of all, the extension to 2 years is currently being considered by the board of IPAF. Second, these small grants are only a small instrument that is complementary to larger grants and even more to our big loans project. And the whole challenge and the whole potential of IPAF is precisely to build these links. There was a question about upscaling. How we support local small projects to bring them into a much larger and mainstream development effort is one of the challenges and one of the potential of IPAF. There were some specific questions regarding capacity building of staff. We are doing some efforts, yes, and choose of the right consultant, and we take this into account. I go to the question of the Asia causes. Two very specific questions. I guess you had access to the draft of our policy document. That means that indeed it has been circulating among the indigenous peoples' movements. First, regarding the independent monitoring mechanism, two things here. First of all, IFAD has an independent office of evaluation. All our projects and our policies can and very often are submitted to an independent evaluation process that assesses this project against their intended objective and impact. This is inbuilt in our institution. The second one, and this is still a project, is the idea of establishing an Indigenous Peoples Forum before our governing council, which is the highest level of our governance systems. We have established 4 years ago now a farmers forum at the governing council of IFAD, which is not part of the formal governance, but which is associated and parallel to it, and which is a moment where actually representatives of the so-called target groups of IFAD can come and speak, have a dialogue with the institution, but also challenge the institution and create this accountability mechanism where the rural poor people select their own representative to go to our governance and say what is wrong and what is right. Okay? We have in mind, and this is actually in the draft of the policy, to establish such an Indigenous Peoples Forum at the Governing Council of IFAD. This will be discussed and hopefully approved in September at our executive board. But there was another question, which is the existence of a complaint mechanism. And this, to tell you the full truth, we have nothing to hide, this was in the draft that was, the first draft that was discussed in our management. And there has been, after long discussion, a decision not to put it in the policy. For a number of reasons that I would not like to go too much into the details on this one, but we believe that if we establish an Indigenous Peoples Forum at IFAD, it will actually serve this very function. From Bolivia, on agrofuel and biofuel. Well, first of all, there are two types of agrofuels. There is the agrofuel of the rural poor. This is taking the woods in the forest and all the traditional energy that is. And there is the industrial agrofuel of our times. IFAD is not at all engaged in promoting industrial agrofuel in any countries. However, and where local populations are interested in promoting crops that may find a market within their own traditional agriculture system, we don't have an opposition to biofuel as to any other kind of crop. If there are demands from peasant campesinos agriculture to include this in their own systems, we are open to supporting them. But certainly not the promotion, I repeat, of industrial biofuel. A question from Mr. Balkassam. Maybe there has been a misunderstanding on the 20%. The 20%, or actually, indeed, actually the 22%, is the part of our loans to government that are financing development projects with indigenous peoples. The rest, the 80%, are also through government, financing development projects for rural poor people, but where they are not priority, the indigenous peoples are either not present in these rural areas or are not a priority target of the project. We are indeed monitoring both the 20 and the 80, all our projects, through our supervision system, and also through what I said before, which is this independent evaluation of our project to be sure that the intended beneficiaries and the intended benefits are actually materializing, which is not always the case, obviously, but the fact that we do monitor is important. I think...
Norway.
Yes, Norway. Well, to which extent our next strategic framework or how our next strategic framework will take into account indigenous peoples' issue. We owe a new strategic framework to our governance at the end of 2010. We will start soon working on it because it's a long process. And I cannot obviously give you a full answer to this question because it's not only a long process, but a process on which we don't have full control. Our governance is very much in charge of that also. But one thing I can say is that if, as I hope, in September we will have an approved policy on engagement with indigenous peoples, it is certainly a guarantee that indigenous peoples will remain and be even more present in the new strategic framework of IFAD that will be approved in 2010. The fact that the declaration on the right of indigenous people is approved today, it was not when we started the current strategic framework, will also help. So there are all reasons, sorry, and also the UNDG, obviously, guidelines. So I would say that there are many reasons that indigenous peoples will not be less, but probably more present in the new strategic framework. One thing I can also say is that the whole problematic of climate change and the whole issue of natural resource management will be probably stronger in this new strategic framework for reasons that are quite obvious. And on this, maybe, I don't know if Antonella, you would like to add something to the question?
More that, I don't know if I have an answer. Okay. I would like to add only one information on the consultation process with indigenous peoples and IFAD, which were raised by the forum. And shortly, just to say that soon after Johannesburg meeting and the partnership with the UN Permanent Forum, from February 2003, when during the Governing Council IFAD hosted the first seminar on indigenous peoples' issues, throughout January 2009, at least once a year, if not twice a year, we had consultation with indigenous peoples' leaders at headquarters. We took all the opportunities to also have the forum present. For instance, in 2006, in September, even before the declaration was approved, the chair of the UN Permanent Forum addressed our executive board on advocacy on the declaration. At a regional level, through the facility, recently we had two workshops, one in Asia and one in Latin America, meeting with the organizations who got the grants and also trying to push a process where the organization at grassroots level meet with regional organization and also with the members of the forum. So to also build this networking that would be at regional level among those organizations, but growing up from the bottom up to the UN Permanent Forum. So just to respond that we continuously make effort, and it has now become a tradition at IFAD that whenever indigenous people's issues are addressed, we would like to have indigenous people's representatives with us and not us talking on their behalf.
Thank you very much, Antonella. I'd like now to call on Elisa, if you can make some very brief concluding remarks. Margaret, are you going to make one? Because we now have the representative from UNFPA with us to use the next time slot. Yes.
Thank you very much. I want to take this time to give my gratitude to the panel that has been discussing with us. That is the staff of IFAD. I must say sincerely the dialogue has been constructive and it has been very interesting. That's why you saw that there was full participation of participants. And of course, when we talk about support to indigenous peoples, everybody would want to know what exactly happens. And I'm happy that you've elaborated more of what IFAD does. And on that note, I would want to urge you, it is of very paramount importance that you continue giving loans or grants to programs at country and regional level. And also, I would wish that you continue supporting activities or projects of indigenous peoples that increase awareness of their rights and cultural identity, that increase capacity in communities, and also support activities or projects that give empowerment to indigenous women. On this note, I would wish to thank you very much, and we shall continue in dialogue in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Elisa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tengo tres puntos como finales.
I have 3 points. I would like once again, of course, to thank you for this opportunity of a direct dialogue with between yourselves and the indigenous peoples. We hope that your policy will continue in September. And we also trust that above and beyond that, there will be actual implementation, because there aren't many good examples of good policies for indigenous peoples such as your own. We don't see that so much in other agencies, and we trust that there will in fact be implementation. One interesting and important point for the indigenous peoples would be sustainability of this mechanism which has been set up for the indigenous peoples. I was wondering how long it would still survive. Perhaps we should think that within the context of implementation of the policy, that we might think that this mechanism might be part of the IFAD system and not just one little fund by itself. And then efforts should be made to ensure that the beneficiaries are the indigenous peoples themselves and not any intermediaries. I think we have already learned lessons, and they can help us so that one can work directly with indigenous organizations. In January, at the level of the communities, there were some groups that didn't meet the administrative requirements for attending. But perhaps these small indigenous organizations can be treated like the big ones if they have the technical capacity, and that would help them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, my colleague Elisa Kankimolo. Well, let me thank the colleagues from IFAD, Jean-Philippe, Odine, Antonella, and Zenia for taking time out to be with us. I'm sure there are still questions that are not answered, but you can really deal with those later on with some of our colleagues as well as some of the indigenous peoples or governments who ask the questions. And I just like to say that from my perspective, the IFAD, which is an international financial institution like the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank, is quite a unique one in the sense that it has really done a lot of work in terms of engaging, getting indigenous peoples to engage more actively with them. It was the first time that the Permanent Forum had some meetings with the governing body of the institution, which is not very, which doesn't happen very often. And also at some point, IFAD in fact appointed an assistant president to take care of indigenous people's issues. Unfortunately, that post is not there anymore, but I think IFAD should rethink of reinstituting that post, because it does give a big signal that IFAD is seriously really wanting to address the issues of indigenous peoples, considering that they are the body dealing with the rural poor. And definitely among the rural poor, a big number of these are indigenous people. So let me thank you once again, and we will continue this kind of dialogue, not here, but also in other venues. Thank you very much. Okay, let me now ask the dear colleagues from UNFPA to come around. We have with us the Undersecretary General, Ms. Purnima Mane, Mr. Werner Hogg, and Ms. Aminata Tauri. And for this part, I ask my dear colleague, Tonya Gunella Frischner, to chair, so that, as she is also the one in charge of this agenda item. So I'd like Tonya to also come up to the floor. So let us have the colleagues from UNFPA to please take their seats. Thank you very much for coming. Sorry about the little delay. I'll let Tonya chair this part.
What is that? Thank you.
Tonya will chair.
No, but I think she's sitting here.
Yeah, so she is sitting here. Yeah.
I'm not allowed to misrepresent myself. No.
Oh, she walks me through everything. Don't worry.
Yeah, okay.
Assistant Secretary.
Okay. And who is to my right? And from the three minutes will be sitting.
Okay. Okay. Purnima Mane. This is the, like an accent. Mane.
Mane. Would you prefer to go first?
It's up to you. Okay. Because once I start, then the others will follow. So if you're starting, it will probably be better.
Okay. And I thought she wanted me to use that.
Go to, no, we don't have member states on this one.
No. Okay.
We don't have organizations.
Yes, right here.
Here.
Okay. Okay.
Name, and we'll go to ask for.
So first you give the floor.
Mm-hmm. I'll start here.
Questions on the permanent forum.
Yes.
And then we'll go to this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Dear brothers and sisters, if we could have your attention, please. Our distinguished colleagues from UNFPA have arrived. And as you know, we are completing the dialogue with the six UN agencies, and we are finishing the last round of our dialogue. And the UN agency, UNFPA, has so graciously agreed to be part of this dialogue. And I have the great honor to introduce to you the Deputy Executive Director, who will make the opening statement, and that is Pername Mane, and I hope very much that I have pronounced her beautiful name correctly. And Madam Deputy Executive Director, you have the floor. Thank you very much.
For the record, it's Purnima Mane. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the forum, excellencies, distinguished delegates, dear indigenous friends, ladies and gentlemen, UNFPA would like to express its gratitude to the members of the Permanent Forum and to the Secretariat for allowing us to participate today. It's truly an honor to be part of the forum's first in-depth dialogue with the United Nations agencies, programs, and funds. Participating in this dialogue provides us with a unique opportunity to listen to your concerns and to learn from your wisdom. UNFPA is continuing its efforts to mainstream indigenous issues throughout its strategies and programs. We are pleased to have included in our report to the Permanent Forum information on some of our programs which support indigenous peoples in around 24 countries from Latin America and the Caribbean and the Asia-Pacific region. It's also our pleasure to inform you that in line with the recommendations of the forum, UNFPA has continued to intensify its efforts to promote and mainstream a culturally sensitive approach to its programs at the global, regional, and country levels. This approach, which furthers human rights principles through the understanding and respect of different traditions, cultural backgrounds, religious and ethical values, is central for UNFPA's work in dealing with indigenous issues. In the area of health, for example, UNFPA is aware that there are aspects which are particularly relevant to indigenous peoples. Providing pertinent and effective health services depends on the ability of medical and social services to accommodate cultural understandings, perceptions, and practices. From our many years of experience, UNFPA and our partners are learning how to better deliver intercultural reproductive health information, education, and services respecting indigenous peoples' worldviews and cultures. UNFPA's programs aim to improve the reproductive health of indigenous peoples with an emphasis on reducing maternal mortality and morbidity while empowering them to advocate for their own rights, including their reproductive ones. For example, UNFPA has been supporting interventions focused on providing indigenous women with quality health care, including emergency obstetric care, voluntary family planning, and skill attendance at birth, as well as HIV and gender-based violence prevention in Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guyana, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, Cambodia, Laos People's Democratic Republic, Nepal, and Vietnam, among others. Important results have been achieved through the promotion of intercultural health models in which different health systems coexist and complement each other. These models encourage the participation of local traditional midwives and indigenous healers, acting as cultural brokers between indigenous worldviews on health and Western medical practices. UNFPA also carries out data collection and evidence-based studies, advocacy, and promotion of indigenous people's rights, strengthening of indigenous women's networks and local community organizations, and bilingual literacy programs. Promotion of bilingual education with sexual and reproductive health contents has been critical for women and youth empowerment and development, including better health outcomes for present and future generations. UNFPA is also aware that Indigenous people's perception of the world is essential to their identity. Development policies must reflect and reinforce those understandings. Indigenous peoples have much to contribute to development, assuring them the space to become architects and agents of their own development is central. I'd like to conclude by saying that UNFPA is committed to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and will continue to support its implementation and dissemination to ensure that it reaches all sectors of society. In fact, the adoption of the Declaration, along with the support it has received from governments, has been a key facilitating factor for our work on indigenous issues. I'd like now, Madam Chair, to give the floor to our representatives from Ecuador, Mexico, and Vietnam, who are here in New York today to address the forum briefly and talk about their rich experiences of working to advance the rights of indigenous peoples in their respective countries. We sincerely believe that today's in-depth dialogue will provide a great opportunity to discuss how UNFPA can further contribute to improving the lives and promoting and protecting the human rights of indigenous peoples throughout the world. We look forward to continuing to build on the recommendations that will be made by this forum. Thank you very much. May I now call on... No, go ahead. Okay. I just want to make sure that I'm calling them out in the right order. Mm-hmm. It's Jorge Parra, Alfonso Sandoval, and Bruce Campbell.
If I may.
Señora Presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I would like to tell you what the UNFPA is doing in Ecuador. Ecuador is a country in South America, 6.8% indigenous population. However, that figure could be larger, and probably, in fact, it actually is larger. But what happens is we need more sources of information, and we need to do a lot of work in order to find out what is the actual size of the indigenous population. There are significant gaps in health, education, income level, and employment between the indigenous and non-indigenous populations. For example, access to professional attendance at birth is just 30% compared to 70% in non-indigenous populations. Unintended fertility is also higher in the indigenous population, where they have 1.4 more children than they wished. Maternal mortality is also a problem in Ecuador and indeed in all the Andean countries. And clearly it is more of a problem for our indigenous women. Attendance at school also just 2.5 years for indigenous women. Now, what is the country doing to improve this? Since 2008, there has been a new constitution which recognizes the rights of the indigenous peoples. The Ecuador National Development Plan has a special chapter to ensure the social inclusion and the development of the indigenous peoples. Within this context, the UNFPA wishes to work together with the country, aligning itself with the national priorities. Now, what are we actually doing? First and foremost, we are seeking to ensure that an intercultural approach prevails and that we take account of cultural factors in public policy. We need to provide evidence here, facts, and this means research studies. For example, in the national census, we have to have variables covering the indigenous sector of the population. With the National Statistics Office, we have set up a special committee to develop statistics for indigenous people in Ecuador. That technical committee is working on getting information, data about indigenous people. Then on sexual and reproductive health, one has to take into account the world view of the indigenous people. It's not just a question of providing a health service that is culturally adaptable. Rather, one has to understand the world outlook of the indigenous people. They see health holistically. It's not just a health sickness or disease approach, which is how the Western world sees it. So we have to study the outlook, the beliefs of the indigenous people, and that is what we are trying to do in Ecuador. And that is why we have developed complementary, not parallel systems. It's not just a parallel system, Western medicine and indigenous health, because if we take those two separate approaches, we will never solve the problem. What we want to do is develop integrated, holistic, complementary systems. Then on the gender issue, we are working together with Ecuador in combating gender-based violence. This is sometimes a hidden problem, but it is one that we have to work to prevent in the country. And so we have to strengthen organizations of indigenous women so that they can defend their right to a violence-free life. Now, what are the challenges today? We already have a constitution, a national development plan, and we have to make sure that there are now effective public policies so that there is no discrimination, so that there is greater social inclusion. Of course, consensus is needed, time is needed, because decrees and laws are not enough to put an end to discrimination. And we also have to take account of the economic crisis, how this is going to affect the development of indigenous peoples. And we have to give priority to those groups so that they can cope with the fallout from the crisis. We have to strengthen the space for dialogue between the government and the indigenous peoples. And above all, we have to make sure that indigenous women and the indigenous people, they need our support, and without them, there can be no true national development. Thank you.
I would like to thank very warmly Mr. Jorge Pada, the representative of UNFPA from Ecuador, and also Madame Manet, the Deputy Executive Director of UNFPA, who spoke earlier, and their excellent comments. I will make some short remarks after all of our speakers do make their remarks. The next speaker is Alfonso Sandoval, the Assistant Representative of UNFPA from Mexico. And Mr. Sandoval, you have the floor, sir.
Gracias.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to refer briefly to the situation of indigenous peoples in Mexico in the area of population, and then to the activities and the challenges that we see from the standpoint of the UN Population Fund and the country. As you know, Mexico is a diverse and complex country. While it has a high degree of human development, on the average, 43% of its population is still living in poverty and 14% in conditions of abject poverty. In terms of its ethnic composition, more than 12 million of its population are indigenous people, belonging to 68 ethno-linguistic groups. Out of these, six concentrate more than half of the indigenous population: the Nahuatl, Maya, Mixteco, Zapoteco, Xental, and Tzotzil account for this. Among issues of population and development which are important in Mexico, we have the following. There are significant progress has been made in generating sociodemographic information. Our population censuses in Mexico include data now for over a century, and in the demographic surveys of the last decades, we consider important ethnic variables. Nevertheless, there are gaps and inconsistencies in the information which translate, for example, into the persistence of discussions around their estimates as to the number of indigenous population and the various ways in which to include them, in particular having to do with the use of indigenous languages and this is still under discussion, for example, in considering the census of 2010. Demographic changes are occurring rapidly in the indigenous population. Fertility and mortality are falling, and their participation in migration flows from one region of the country to another, as well as to the United States, is increasing. At present, more than one-third of the indigenous people of Mexico live outside their traditional territory. In terms of the situation of indigenous peoples in the area of reproductive health, despite the progress made in the last few years, there are important problems. For example, 22% of the indigenous population has very limited access or no access at all to health services. Maternal mortality among indigenous women is three times that of non-indigenous women as a result of problems of access, quality, and lack of cultural adequacy of services in many cases. More than 20% of indigenous women say that they would like to limit or to space their offspring, but they cannot do so owing to lack of access to health services or because of various sociocultural barriers. We call this an unsatisfied demand of family planning, one of the clearest indicators of the right to reproductive health. To contribute to solving these problems, the Population Fund for more than a decade now has been supporting initiatives and projects in the area of health, reproductive and sexual health services, such as strengthening the cultural adequacy of services through federal and state health institutions. Also by developing community health care models on reproductive health, such as those of collective consultations in Chiapas and the care of migrant women in Oaxaca, or integrating indigenous and institutional medicine in Nahuatl and Penic populations. This has been particularly effective in reducing maternal mortality rates. We have also supported various programs and projects on education, communication on reproductive and sexual rights, gender equality and rights, such as the cultural adequacy of this content in indigenous education programs for adults, including literacy and basic education programs. The development of the methodology and material for literacy in some indigenous languages, the development of material in indigenous languages, including printed material, audiovisuals, and so forth, and the development of participatory programs on communication with indigenous youth, including musical composition, songs, theater, etc. In the terms of population and development, the Population Fund has promoted and participated in several initiatives to achieve better analysis and use of sociodemographic information about indigenous peoples. We have supported the establishment of a national network on the study of indigenous peoples. Under our cooperation program, we have undertaken studies on reproductive health, indigenous migration, and other topics. And we have a pilot project on population, environment, and sustainable development in Lacandona jungle, whose experience can be used in other areas of the state of Chiapas. Among the lessons learned from all of these initiatives, we highlight the need for constant and honest dialogue with all organizations and institutions involved, as well as the importance of consolidating local task forces made up of community participants. And we also view many challenges for the future, but I'd like to mention three. That of achieving full integration of the needs of indigenous peoples in all components of information, statistical, and demographic systems of the country. Number two, to mainstream the approach to human rights and in particular indigenous rights in our cooperation for development. And number three, to strengthen the ties of cooperation and the participation of indigenous organizations in programs of population and development, reproductive health, and gender equality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sandoval, for your presentation and excellent information. I would like to call on Mr. Bruce Campbell, the representative of UNFPA from Vietnam. Mr. Campbell, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's truly an honor to be here with our colleagues this morning. I'm going to make a brief presentation about reproductive health services for ethnic minorities in Vietnam. And I'm making that presentation on behalf of UNFPA as well as the UN country team and the people of Vietnam as well. Vietnam is a country of almost 85 million people. It's a large country. It's going through rapid changes economically. It recently joined the World Trade Organization. Soon, perhaps within the next 12 to 24 months, we'll reach middle income status, meaning $1,000 per capita per person. But yet it's a country of great ethnic diversity. Of that 86 or 85 million population, there are 54 different ethnic groups. The major ethnic group is the King themselves, often known as Viet. It's about 86 or 87%. And then there are seven larger ethnic groups that range between 1 and 2%. And then a remaining 46 ethnic groups that are each less than 1% of the population, some just several thousand, up to several hundred thousand population. So there's quite a large ethnic diversity, mostly along the borders in the mountainous regions, the borders of China and Laos. Vietnam has registered some extremely impressive gains in the last few years against the Millennium Development Goals. In fact, most of the MDGs have already been attained. For example, the proportion of poor households has rapidly decreased. And by 2000, universal education had almost been attained. In fact, in university, we have more women attending than men. There have been registered declines in infant mortality and child mortality as well. However, and I think it's important, and that's one of the areas UNFPA has been very interested in monitoring, these national figures, these impressive gains, often mask much poorer performance in some specific provinces and districts. And there are some large discrepancies that have been noticed. And sure enough, as one might suspect, the minorities remain and continue to remain the most vulnerable. And despite targeting of social services, we still see poverty rates approximately three times higher for the ethnic minorities in Vietnam than the population as a whole. And if we look at specifically at reproductive health and using the indicator of maternal mortality, we see on average the maternal mortality for all ethnic groups around 316, whereas those for the Kin, the majority, is around 81. And even further discrepancies exist, approximately 10 times difference for some groups between 411 on down to 45 maternal mortality rates. The government has made some tremendous efforts to address these discrepancies already. 1,919 communes have been identified, and specific investments have been made in terms of road infrastructure, communications, postal systems, even cultural centers being established in these areas of increased vulnerability. And efforts continue to be made with a vision for the next decade of significantly increased resources for these areas. In terms of what the UN has done, and that's I really speak on behalf of UNFPA, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNAIDS, in terms of addressing reproductive health issues, we've had a fairly top-down approach so far, and if we look at the past decade, of dissemination of information and education, provision of supplies and equipment to health facilities, and some training of health workers, and we have a long history. But what we noted is that despite those efforts in areas where the ethnic minorities are more prominent, we have quite low utilization rates as contrasted with the rest of the country. So more recently, and following a series of prospective sociocultural research, some quite substantive qualitative research, we've kind of relooked at our strategy, and together again with our UN colleagues and the bilateral community and some civil society partners have begun training ethnic midwives. Ethnic midwives from communities where they will return to serve. We've also opened up a very systematic dialogue with, in particular, female members of the community, but also ethnic minority leaders and young people, looking at what else we can do in terms of increasing access in these more remote and hard-to-reach communities. And we've gone ahead and recruited ethnic minorities on our staff and in our program field offices. And most recently, we've just completed between April 1st and April 15th the population and housing census. And special effort was made to ensure that we had detailed information on ethnic minorities. So in terms of the way forward and a few challenges that still remain, in order for ethnic minorities to maintain and strengthen their indigenous culture while gaining universal access to reproductive health services, it's really become clear that it's very different than countries where you have low coverage and where you really need to just plain increase the supply side. That's not seeming to work in the context of Vietnam. And that here we have to look at, we have to review that and examine our approaches in light of the special needs of the minorities. And we also have to realize that we don't have a simple answer. We can't simply train ethnic midwives and expect them to deliver women in their home, because perhaps some of you know that complicated deliveries will require access to trained, access to facilities, to comprehensive emergency obstetric care, to cesarean section, and higher level services. So we're really looking at a challenge of, one, trying to encourage as much service to be provided as close as possible to home, and at the same time improving access to higher level services. I think it's very clear that broader support will have to continue as well, road infrastructure, communication channels, and so forth for these communities. And then finally, to address the very sensitive nature of universal access to sexual and reproductive health services, we'll have to maintain that systematic dialogue with women and men in the reproductive ages. And that's not an easy thing to do. That requires regular contact at community level, and that's a long-term that will require a long-term program support. I think one last thing is that it became perfectly clear to us that there will be no one-size-fits-all approach to what we're doing with minorities. And ultimately, as we develop, and this is the year that we're developing the next 10-year strategy for population and reproductive health, we'll have to end up with a strategy that's flexible enough to be adopted to the needs of each and every one of those 54 ethnic groups. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell, for your excellent remarks. If I may, as chair, I would like to respond to just a few comments, if I may. The representatives from UNFPA have been extremely helpful, at least for me as chair of this dialogue, in what they have shared, certainly in the materials that we have received previously and what they have brought to us today. Madam Manea, the Deputy Executive Director of UNFPA, her statements in regard to the agency's commitment to the declaration and its distribution, of course, touches the hearts of everyone here from Indigenous communities, because everyone knows how important the declaration is to all of us and what that means to us. So we thank her very, very much for that comment. Knowing that the reproductive health and is coming from a cultural perspective, and the bilingual literacy programs are going on within the agency is very important to Indigenous peoples, and I thank you, Madam Director, for your comments. Mr. Parra, the representative from Ecuador, the maternal mortality rate of course, is a great concern for us, and the integration of health holistically must, of course, be integrated with the two systems. And we do agree with you with that on that basis. The gender-based violence is an issue, and of course, the economic crisis that is going on will influence that and will have a great effect on Indigenous peoples. So we are all looking closely at that. Mr. Sandoval, the statistics that you shared with us are quite disconcerting, and being that 43% live in poverty and most our Indigenous peoples are of great concern to us, and the inconsistency in data regarding Indigenous peoples is not just with the government of Mexico, but we see that throughout the international community. And the fact that 22% have no access to health services is of great concern, and that many have no access to family planning is of great concern as well. And Mr. Campbell, in reference to Vietnam, the maternal mortality rates, of course, are high, and we are happy to hear that UNFPA is addressing that issue. The low utilization rates of information by the communities, we would like, I believe, a little bit more information about why that is happening. So maybe if you could address that throughout our dialogue. We are happy to hear the recruitment of local people by UNFPA is one step. And, of course, the infrastructure is a problem. And working with government will be one way to deal with the problem that you have of getting information out. And roads and other infrastructures will pose a barrier for getting out information. But the information that and excellent information that we have received today has just been a great eye-opener for all of us here today. So I thank you very much for all your information. My colleagues who are assigned and to our dialogue today are Madame Pemene Hassa, and she is going to, and also Lillian Mazangi are assigned to UNFPA. And Ms. Lillian will begin the discussion. She will begin the questions. Ms. Anga, you have the floor. No, Pamanate? I have some confusion, and that is my fault. Madame Hassan, you take the floor. Pemene. And unfortunately, her light is not on. Pemene. They've turned on my light by mistake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to pose several questions, and along with my questions, after that, my colleague Lillian will pose some questions. So we will go with one set of questions. After the reflection to those questions, we will have the second set of our questions. So just to be more focused for our UNDP colleagues, to reflect on the comments and questions. The first part is the adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, as we know, has created a historic momentum in terms of the legal and policy basis for action on indigenous issues. The question comes that how does UNFPA perceive the impact of the declaration, its activities and overall directions? We heard that our Honorable Executive Director spoke about the declaration and having that into consideration. The Permanent Forum has issued a specific recommendations on implementation of Article 42 of the declaration. Does UNFPA intend to collaborate with the Permanent Forum, and how in ensuring the implementation of the declaration, and especially Article 42, will be for the UNFPA. In the report of the UNFPA to the 8th session of the Permanent Forum, it notes that in some instances, political conditions can create opportunities for advancing indigenous women's rights and promoting the incorporation of an intercultural perspective into public policies and reproductive health services for indigenous women. The question is, in instances of favorable political conditions, how does UNFPA ensure the implementation of free, prior, and informed consent in the development of national and local health policy, and also in instances of state reluctance, how does UNFPA promote and secure the inclusion of indigenous issues and peoples into national public policy formulation processes, and to what extent UNFPA is able to involve itself and undertake projects in areas where the state is either absent or fails to recognize indigenous peoples. On the regions of Latin America and Asia, in the report to the 8th session of the Permanent Forum from the UNFPA, the question comes, in what countries has UNFPA been most effective in the advancement of its work on indigenous issues, and what have been UNFPA's main substantive areas of cooperation? I also like to ask if you could please assess the barriers to undertaking projects focused on indigenous peoples in other regions. Madam Chair, I stop at this part, and I ask my dear colleague Lillian to pose some questions. So later on we'll come back to the second set. Thank you.
Merci, ma chère collègue Pena.
Thank you, dear colleague. Madam Chair, before going into the subject matter, I would like to thank all speakers for their excellent presentations, which will be constructive for this system of dialogue that we have established among agencies, funds, programs of the United Nations system. And I know that with UNFPA, we have always had a very constructive dialogue. With regard to the declaration, I have a more specific question to add to the question by my colleague Bemane. In the framework of Article 42C, colleagues of UNFPA have offered information, and I wonder whether they can mention how to approach the main challenges in the areas of gender, health, children, and youth. Still in the context of health, and this is a second question, the statements made by country representatives have been quite eloquent, but we have noticed that there are challenges ahead. Challenges with regard to stereotypes, which appear in among various groups which are not indigenous. How is UNFPA approaching the strict implementation of Article 24 of the declaration with respect to the stereotypes? Because Article 24 in paragraph 2 says that indigenous people have a right to have the best possible health, and that states should adopt necessary measures to ensure the full realization of that right. I have a third question, and that will be my last one for the moment. In the day-to-day management, indigenous peoples risk natural disasters, which are a threat to the world, but to which they are more vulnerable. As we know, indigenous peoples have knowledge that could be used to prevent those catastrophes which the world faces from time to time. Can UNFPA give us an example of a region where it has been able to integrate traditional knowledge in order to reduce the vulnerability of the indigenous people there in particular, as well as to protect their livelihood and their means of development. And I stop at this third question. So that UNFPA representatives have the time to respond, and then we would, my colleague Bename and myself would have other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hassan, did you want to include a question? And you'll make it brief, please. Thank you.
أود أن أشكر السيدة ماني نائبة المدير التنفيذي والسيد هوري بارا مندوب الإكواد في الصندوق في الإكوادور والمندوبين الآخرين. في البداية لاحظت. No translation. Good. There is no translation. I will. Good. No translation? Good. نعم، هل هناك ترجمة؟ لا؟
Can the interpretation be heard? Yes, there is interpretation. First of all, may I say thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I would like to thank Ms. Money of UNFPA and the UNFPA representatives, whose names, unfortunately, I don't remember. I would like to thank them all. There was one point made by the representative from Ecuador. To wit, we need complementary health services. In their policies of assimilation, some authorities want to put an end to traditional health services, traditional health systems, on the grounds they could be detrimental, and they seek an alternative. I myself, as a child, was always healed using traditional methods, including substances from trees and plants. So the traditional health approach is one that is widely used in some countries. In UNFPA, I wonder whether you do any work on this, traditional medicinal plants. Sometimes they are marketed without the knowledge or consent of the indigenous people, and indeed sometimes there are international corporations that take advantage of this and make a lot of money out of it. For example, argan oil is widely used, but there is no benefit to the indigenous people who produced it. So I wondered if there was any possibility for UNFPA to think about establishing partnerships between the indigenous people and the authorities and the international companies that use traditional medicinal plants. I believe that Mexico has played a very important part in achieving the Declaration on the Rights of the Indigenous Peoples. But I think that UNFPA, I believe that there is another aspect to your situation. There is poverty, and I think there were some very disturbing data cited in your presentation. On the one hand, the policy of assimilation throughout the world has played a very important part in destroying the identity of the indigenous peoples. And that policy of assimilation has also destroyed their pattern of life and their potential development. This is a question to Mexico, but I believe we're having a dialogue here. Do you have any plan to use the slogan of partnership between the fund and the indigenous people and the government of Mexico? So this is a general question and also addressed to Mexico. Thank you.
I would like to thank my colleagues, Lilian, Pamene, and Hassan. And we are going to allow our two focal points, Lilian and Pamene, to finish their questions. If my colleagues would allow that, please. And I am going to turn the questions, and now we're going to allow the Honorable Executive Director to answer the questions that have been presented by Lilian and Pamene at this point. Madam Executive Director.
Thank you very much for your interest and for the excellent questions. In order to ensure that we can do justice to them, and we will try in the time that has been provided to us, I'm going to turn to my colleagues and request them to address specific questions, but I'm also going to request my colleagues to be brief to permit the second set of questions. And, of course, we'd like to assure you that we are very interested in the dialogue, and if there's anything we're not able to respond, we would be happy to provide the answers in writing. Let me first turn to my colleague, Werner Hogg, who's the director of our technical division, who will respond to the questions related to the impact of the declaration and how we plan to collaborate with the Permanent Forum.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the opportunity to have this dialogue with you. Regarding the impact of the declaration, I'm happy to tell you that the declaration has already had an impact on our work. We are starting to consider much more seriously the situation of the ethnic minorities and indigenous people with respect to our programs, and we are happy that, in fact, the program of action of the International Conference on Population and Development, which is our reference, goes very well hand in hand with basic principles of the declarations and allows us to really advance indigenous people's rights and particularly the rights of women. In our programming, we are taking into account questions of inequity very seriously, and indigenous people and ethnic minorities are very often very strongly concerned by inequities relating to poverty, but also relating to their cultural particularities of their groups. And these two dimensions, or three dimensions, inequity, poverty, and also the cultural specificities of the groups, are very important for our work. But we recognize, on the other hand, the need to continue the training of our staff and of our implementing partners in the country so that they understand the full importance and relevance of the declarations for their work and in their advocacy efforts. To give you some more specific examples how we try to work and plan to work together with the forum and to strengthen the implementation of the declaration. I would just like to mention that on the global level, UNFPA is a member of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues, and we cooperated very closely in the elaboration of the interagency guidelines. And these guidelines, again, which are inspired by the declaration, have been disseminated by the senior management of UNFPA to all our country offices in order to promote their use in the programming and also to promote their use in the UN country teams, the joint UN country teams efforts, in particularly in the field of health, but also in the field of gender equity. We made a particular effort, as you know, in the Latin America and Caribbean region, where the declaration and also the recommendations of this forum and the UNDG guidelines were used to really integrate indigenous people's issues into the country programs. You heard a couple of examples from our colleagues, and many offices, UNFPA offices, have also distributed the text of the declaration, and including its translation into indigenous people's languages and the printing of them in a couple of cases, also in Latin America, but also in Vietnam, for instance. And even in countries such as China, we have contributed to the dissemination of the principles of the declaration to sensitize the central, but also and particularly the regional and local level about the issues which are of concern to you. And we hope very much that we can strengthen this effort. We will build on what you have already done, and we are really looking forward to the future cooperation with the forum and with all the your communities in our respective countries. I would like to hand now over to my colleague Aminata Touré, Chief of the Gender, Culture and Human Rights Branch.
Seems like I'm not having the mic.
Okay. Thank you very much, Werner. I'd like to address a set of three questions. The first one, just to recall it, was that in instance of favorable political condition, how does we ensure, we UNFPA, the implementation of free, prior, and informed consent in the development of national and local health policies? The key words here is partnership. Partnership with the government. We take a lot of effort in carrying out processes of in-depth consultation in countries with all aligned ministers in order to include indigenous people's views in the whole programming process. Of course, that required times and patience, but we believe that government are key in doing that, and we spend quite a lot of effort in convincing them through advocacy. The second key element strategy is really what we call the human rights-based approach combined with the culturally sensitive approach. UNFPA makes sure that in whatever project we conduct, we make sure that we secure the consent of indigenous people, and we also ensure their direct involvement. So this is how we believe we can further the taking into consideration the needs and rights of indigenous people into the different programming. There was another question related to reluctance of states. If it happened, how does UNFPA promote and secure the inclusion of indigenous issues? And again, I think it's important to highlight that in our intervention, we combine both advocacy toward government, but also building the capacities of indigenous organizations. They have been key partners, as it was highlighted by the colleagues coming from different countries, that they are key partners in this approach. For instance, we have supported the inclusion of indigenous people issues in data collection exercise. We worked with them. It's important that their needs and rights be reflected when we conduct censuses, house censuses, and health surveys. because if you are not counted, it's very difficult to address your needs from the policy and programmatic perspective. So we do that in the countries where we are involved. Another way also of convincing government is really to develop what we call models. We pilot in some regions some very specific project addressing the needs and rights of indigenous people. And based on the result, we demonstrate to government the value added of addressing the rights and needs of indigenous people using these models. And the third question I like to answer in this first round, the question was, to what extent is UNFPA able to involve itself and undertake projects in areas where states is either absent or fail to recognize indigenous people? In all countries, UNFPA worked, I must emphasize that, and I would not do it enough here, we really play the role of the honest broker between the government, the civil societies, and indigenous organizations. We, as the UN, it's our role to make sure that this dialogue happens using the different evidence I talk about. One example that I can bring here is from Panama, for instance, the Ngobe people of Panama, an indigenous group. Today, after 10 years of working with indigenous women on intercultural reproductive health, we are happy to report that the pilot experience that we had led to the development of a maternal mortality reduction strategy. And of course, it reflects very strongly the needs and rights of indigenous women. So that, again, partnership and advocacy is, I would say, the key words in convincing government, but also building the capacities of indigenous organizations. There was two questions. One was about the countries where we are most effective, and another one was on how do we work to empower indigenous women in particular. I would leave the first one maybe to my colleague Nidhi, and the second one to my colleague Sonia.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much to the Permanent Forum and the members of the forum. Just a few points as to where UNFPA has been most effective, in which countries. Perhaps in Latin America and the Caribbean and Asia, these are regions where there has been most progress made on the rights of the indigenous peoples. But I'd like to say that that progress has been supported by the UNFPA, and it has been in support of what's been done by the governments and, of course, by the indigenous peoples themselves. And sometimes the circumstances have been conducive. For example, in Latin America, democratic regimes appeared, and this, of course, made it much easier to get recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples, and this has now been reflected in the constitutions in some parts of some countries. In Latin America, in particular, it's been possible to move ahead with recognition of indigenous peoples in the constitutions. On the more substantive areas of our work, I believe that UNFPA has implemented some of the recommendations from the forum at earlier sessions. One of them put emphasis on acquiring statistics and data about indigenous peoples. This is something which we are still working on for census and also for all kinds of surveys and also for administrative purposes in the ministries of education and health, for example. We try to get a breakdown of the statistics to show where there are gaps in services and so forth. And we use the data for that. We're doing that in many countries in the region, for example, Guatemala, Mexico, Bolivia, Ecuador. That's just some of them. Then another substantive area is access by indigenous women in particular to health services. I think that in UNFPA, in the case of Latin America, for example, and Asia, we wonder why indigenous people don't use the health services. So once we asked that question, we went to the women themselves and asked them, why don't you use the health services? And so we're now working on various strategies so that we can work with the ministries of health with a view to formulating intercultural health services, trying to break down the cultural barriers which do still exist in the health services area. When we ask why women don't use the health services, we find it's not just geographical distance, it's not just poverty. Rather, it's also that they feel there's discrimination which still exists in some cases in the public health services vis-a-vis indigenous women. So we're working to break down those barriers, and this would be a key in reducing maternal mortality, particularly in rural areas. Intercultural health service models would take account of traditions, would take account of the languages and the world view of indigenous peoples. And here perhaps I could mention the case of Vietnam. Also in Bangladesh and in Panama, and also in Ecuador, we're working on this intercultural approach. We're also stressing leadership by the indigenous women themselves. An effort is underway to ensure that the organizations themselves can defend their right to health services, reproductive health services at the national level and at the regional level as well. We think this is basic because indigenous people can then exercise their right to take informed decisions about their health and their reproductive health and also to combat any violence that exists. I come from a field office in Ecuador, and one of the lessons learned in Ecuador was that we need synergy with other organizations of the United Nations. In Ecuador, we have an interagency body so that we can work together with other bodies in the UN system, working out a program on cultural diversity and reducing poverty and on social inclusion. And it gets funds from the Spanish government and works together with the government so that at the national development level and also in trying to achieve the MDGs, we are all working together on that. So now let me call on my colleague to talk about cultural issues and cultural barriers. So Aminata, thank you very much.
Actually, I like to, I can answer that directly, but I think the person who would speak much more to that is our cultural advisor, Azza Karam, who could also complement what I'm going to say. Basically, I think I talked a little bit about the different approach that we combine, and it's very specific to UNFPA. And when we look into promoting and advancing the rights of indigenous women, we'll look through three integrated approaches, the first one being advanced gender equality issues within the indigenous community. A second is looking into the human rights-based approach, making sure that they have equal access to all forms of services that we would deliver. And the third one, which is the one Lily referred to, is to be culturally sensitive or relevant to the issue. What we have done so far is to look into different experience across the globe. One in point being, for instance, what is going on in Kenya, where we do have in some of the ethnic minorities the practice of female genital mutilation, which is very much linked to the passage of the child girl or if often the adolescent girl from childhood to womanhood. So it's very much part of the cultural perception of, you know, how do you move from being a child to a woman. And of course, the exercise is to the practice is the cutting of the genitals in some of the groups. We've been developing dialogues with many of these groups in terms of understanding what is the cultural background of such a practice, but also convincing them and of the consequences, the negative consequences on the health of the women in terms of delivering, in terms of consequences related to hemorrhage, etc. And one of the agreement we had with them is to develop what we call alternative rite of passage, where the cultural practice will be kept, but the cutting will be abandoned. So this is a dialogue trying to integrate the right aspect, the health aspect, but also the cultural aspect of it.
Thank you. We are trying our best to address the questions in the time given. So may I call on Jorge Parra to address the questions related to Article 41-42, the challenges we face, 24. Again, Jorge, please be very brief because we would like to get to the others. And just in sync to mention, we will take the question regarding the humanitarian conditions. And Henya, if you could take that next question. Thank you.
Mina. Respecto a...
Thank you very much. On the question on Article 24 and stereotypes, it's true there are some stereotypes among health workers, and some of them see indigenous people as second-class citizens. So what we have to do, and this is something that UNFPA tries to do, is to focus reproductive health services based on rights. And this approach necessarily means that, first of all, the providers acknowledge the right of indigenous peoples and individuals to a higher level of health. And secondly, it means that indigenous people and organizations are aware that health is a right. It's not just somebody's doing them a favor. So UNFPA is carrying out activities to have a rights-based healthcare system. On Article 24, the rights of indigenous people to preserve their traditional medicines and healthcare practices. This, of course, means respect for traditional health and also for traditional culture, and that is how we have to look at it. It's a matter of respect for the cultural and the holistic approach that indigenous people have to health. Provided, of course, that these traditional practices are not harmful and do not themselves run counter to the actual health of the persons involved. So what UNFPA is doing is trying to rescue the traditional knowledge of the indigenous people, to work together with them and to complement them with the traditional healthcare. Alfonso now has something to say.
Gracias.
Thank you very much. There was one specific question. About what UNFPA is doing in Mexico in connection with traditional medicine and the contribution made at the level of patents of medicines. Let me just clarify, this is an issue which does go beyond the mandate of UNFPA. in UNFPA, we do not have any power to act or to take action in the area of patents or trademarks. However, at the level of community issues and reproductive health services, we do try to integrate traditional medicine with Western medicine. Sometimes they call it indigenous medicine and institutional medicine. And this actually is often very much in line with the policy of the Ministry of Health of Mexico. The Ministry of Health of Mexico has an intercultural health program. And calls for integration in all of the healthcare areas. We ourselves have to stay within our mandate. Thank you.
Devuelvo la palabra.
And could I call now on my colleague?
On the question on natural disasters and the knowledge that indigenous people have, for UNFPA, UNFPA works on issues related to emergency preparedness response and recovery. And one of the things that we do promote in our work is basically the indigenous knowledge of how to protect and how to respond to emergencies, because part of their indigenous history and oral history is basically that knowledge. And part of what we do is documenting that and utilizing that in disaster risk reduction. So this is part of what we do on the natural disaster front at the moment, in to include the indigenous knowledge into documentation and utilization that in the disaster risk reduction policies. Thank you.
The permanent forum members and the first speaker to continue with the questions is Pemene. Pemene, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, through you, I like to start the second round of the questions. Which is in recent years, UNFPA has been developing staff capacity in the use of a cultural perspective in its work, and has developed resource materials to facilitate and mainstream a culturally sensitive approach in its development efforts. How has UNFPA been working in countries to incorporate a culturally sensitive and human rights-based approach to reproductive health policies, programs, and care services in line with the recommendations of the Permanent Forum's fifth session? And what have been the main facilitating factors and obstacles encountered? The second part is in the report of the UNFPA to the eighth session of the Permanent Forum, it describes a number of projects undertaken together with indigenous women's organizations, and we heard some from our representatives that they have reported. How has UNFPA contributed to the empowerment of indigenous women's organizations and networks? What has this work consisted of, and what has been its result today? The statement of UNFPA's mission declares that the agency supports countries in using population data for policies and programs to reduce poverty and to ensure reproductive rights and gender equality. Where and how has UNFPA contributed to data collection, analysis, dissemination, and usage? We heard some on the dissemination of data, but somehow broader perspective. How has UNFPA data collection regarding indigenous people contributed to the promotion of their rights? On the area of the programs in the report, how has UNFPA worked to prevent HIV among indigenous peoples and especially indigenous youth? What have been the main lessons learned, and what interventions has UNFPA carried out with regard to migratory movements of indigenous peoples between states? How has UNFPA collaborated with indigenous women in addressing gender-based violence? Which strategies have proven more successful? And how has UNFPA contributed to the recognition of the rights of indigenous youth? Madam Chair, through you, I'd like to give the floor to my dear colleague Lillian to continue some of the questions. Thank you.
Merci.
Thank you, Pemenin. My series of questions has been reduced to fewer because the persons who just answered the previous questions practically responded to all of them, but I still have some. If we are to speak of the Millennium Development Goals, you may recall that our fifth session, we deplored the fact that in the poverty reduction strategy papers, the indigenous dimension was not included. And we asked in recommendations to agencies, funds, and UN institutions, with the assistance of states, of course, to remedy this situation. Has this been done? Has the UNFPA realized that progress has been made? I have a last question, which relates to climate change. We know that climate changes do not come about to make the life of vulnerable populations easier. And my question is, what are the challenges which the fund faces in terms of climate change in the area of health, especially in terms of malaria and HIV/AIDS? What are the challenges? We know that to improve reproductive health, the mothers must be healthy. Whereas we know, and we know that malaria and HIV/AIDS are transmitted from mother to child, and addressing these diseases is an urgent matter in indigenous areas, and this relates to climate change. That is my last question. Thank you very much.
I would like to warmly thank my colleagues, Lillian and Pamene, for their very thorough questions directed to UNFPA. Now, I know our time is getting limited. We do also have a request from the Asian Caucus and from the youth to make a short statement. However, we do have several questions from the permanent forum. I am going to direct the questions to the Honorable Executive Director, and she is going to make sure that the questions, as best as can be done, get answered. And then I'm sure she will either direct the rest in writing or whatever she deems the best in this situation. So, Madam Executive Director.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is actually for us very rewarding that there are so many questions for UNFPA, but in view of the time, what I'm going to try and do is take about 5 to 6 questions and the remaining
we would really be happy to provide in writing, because I don't think we can do justice to them all in the time at hand. So what I'm going to suggest to my colleagues, and please bear with me, is that we will start with the question on staff capacity, the use of a cultural perspective, which I will turn to Azza Karam, who's our senior culture advisor. Very briefly, Bruce can come in after that on the main facilitating factors and obstacles, followed by the question on how has UNFPA contributed to the empowerment of Indigenous women's organizations, and I will turn to Sonia for that. After this, we will take, and I'm going into all of them just so that you're prepared for this. After this, if we can, we may not be able to take the questions on the program areas, but if we have time, we'll be happy to come back to them. After that, if we could take the question on the MDGs, if Sonia could take that question, followed by the question on climate change, which I would request Jorge Parra to take. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and warm greetings to all this distinguished audience. The question that has been directed to me that I have the honor of responding to very, very briefly is how UNFPA's work in countries has incorporated a culturally sensitive and human rights-based approach. Given that my distinguished chief, Ms. Dr. Toure, has already answered part of that question, I shall be even more brief. It's important for me to outline what UNFPA means when we speak of culture. You have all repeated it in different guises. We see culture as all the factors that impact on the way people think, believe, and behave. And therefore, a culturally sensitive approach entails looking at the various agents of change, as we call them, the people, and the ways in which we impact on our work. This means that prior to the design of any of our programs, and bearing in mind that the ultimate objective is to ensure the achievement of human rights, here is what UNFPA undertakes. We take into account the surrounding political, legal, and economic context around any issue. So we see culture as interacting with all of these issues. We also identify the range of government and community-based actors, and here is where our Indigenous partners play a very important role. We take into account not only who the actors are, but what their specific needs and concerns are. We ensure appropriate consultation at all stages, guidance, and full buy-in and ownership from these partners, what we call the agents of change. We try to be as self-conscious as possible, and we hold ourselves accountable to the language, both the written, the spoken, and even the body language that our partners manifest. And we hold ourselves accountable also to being alert to and skilled at mediating and negotiating any potential issues at all times. For several years, we've been developing the capacities of our own staff and our partners in the use of this cultural lens and the perspective. We have developed numerous resource materials to facilitate and to mainstream this human rights-based, culturally sensitive approach. We take into account different worldviews, which is fundamentally about taking into account the different cultural insights. This integrates religious and ethical values simultaneously. We believe that Indigenous people have much to contribute to the development of the work that we do, and that without them, the work that we happen to undertake would be valueless. Thank you.
Yes, if I could just continue on for a moment. We were looking also at facilitating factors as well as obstacles encountered as we make efforts to strengthen the capacity of UNFPA. And in this regard, I think that we can observe that one of the major facilitating factors is when you do have a supportive political environment. And I can refer to the case of Vietnam, where the national government has been extremely supportive in identifying the needs and providing quite substantial resources, technical and financial and other resources, to try to address the needs of the ethnic minorities. And where that is not the case, It's very important, and I think when we talk about strengthening capacity of UNFPA, we also have to think about strengthening capacity of our partners. But we need to look to our civil society partners and the networks that we have around the world, networks both at regional level as well as networks within the countries. There is one example that comes to mind. That's Enlace Continental de Mujeres Indígenas de las Américas, and pardon me for the poor pronunciation, but there are many networks of indigenous people. And so we look to strengthen the capacity of those networks as well. And I had also mentioned earlier, we further try to cement our capacity by recruiting indigenous people wherever possible and making sure that their needs are reflected in all of our discussion. Perhaps, though, I think it's really important to know one of the most significant obstacles encountered is dealing with culture and dealing with human rights and dealing with gender. There's no quick fix. This does take time. It's a very participatory, very bottom-up process, and I think we all need to be patient as we move along this road. One last thing, again, taking an example from Vietnam, we have, as a UN country team with 16 agencies represented, we have a program coordination group that's co-convened by UNFPA and UNIFEM that specifically looks at gender, culture, and human rights and ensures that any investment that we make, any investment whatsoever that any one of the 16 agencies makes, is looked at through a cultural lens as well as through gender and a human rights lens as well. And that's just one other way that we look to strengthen the capacity of our staff and ensure that whatever our modest investments are, that they have the greatest impact possible. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to speak Spanish because several of our main counterparts are here in the room, and they have been working with us in the process of empowerment of indigenous women in Latin America and the Caribbean. Also, the Enlace Continental of Indigenous Women of the Americas. There we have been working with civil society, with Family Care International. We have also been working with organizations of indigenous women's at the community level in countries. And this effort has been similar to what Bruce said. It requires a main element, and that is respect, clarity in the dialogue, and knowing how to take the time that it takes in order to define, together with indigenous women and their organizations, what are their priorities and what are their needs in order to advance their agenda. And obviously, in the context of human rights, as we have been saying here. Through Enlace Continental, beginning last year, we have been strengthening a network which exists in South America, which is led by Tartila, and I will ask to, if we could have two, I will cede 2 minutes of my time to her, because through this organization, organizations of indigenous women are strengthened institutionally as well. They would have the tools to communicate among them. They would have the necessary information. They would have horizontal links, which would allow them to spread information in their organizations. And this is a major challenge, because while in some of the larger institutions like SIDOC, CONAIC, the permanent workshop, there are some computers and some equipment, not all indigenous communities and indigenous women's organizations, such as those in Chile and Argentina, can we say that those assets exist. I will not take much time. This is a matter which I am passionate about, which gives me a reason for living and working in this organization, and I think that this it makes us better persons to learn how to work jointly. Empowering indigenous women on these issues but also on their own agenda is crucial to advance issues such as maternal mortality, adolescent pregnancies, and many of the other issues that they have been discussing over 4 years. I would like to cede the floor to Tartila, and please add some information. Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, brothers and sisters. And thank you very much, brothers and sisters, in the United Nations Population Fund. Following everything that we have heard, we can say that the United Nations Population Fund is, for us, one of the strategic bodies associated and allied with indigenous women. In that regard, the indigenous women who have built this alliance, beginning in 2004, almost 5 years now, we can say that it is 15 years since the Cairo program, and finally indigenous women are realizing that there is such a thing as the Cairo plan, and some of us have contributed to that plan with some recommendations. We are strengthening ourselves, but we're also empowering ourselves to take ownership of this issue and to have an impact on our national policies, but also internationally. Progress has been considerable. For the moment, we are conducting specific work with three countries in South America. We would like all countries where UNFPA is working would open its doors to indigenous women, because even though these are countries which apparently have overcome their economic indicators, women and indigenous peoples are still left pending. In the rural areas, for example, in the case of Argentina, although Argentina may not have needs, women and girls, Toba women and girls, are still suffering from violence. We are 5 years to the millennium goals, and we think that the sources supporting the population fund should continue to support, so that in the remaining 5 years we could conduct research, for example, with specific and disaggregated, to know how much progress has been made in preventing maternal deaths, especially among indigenous women. In terms of the census, forms of communication and education should favor oral forms of communication appropriate to the culture. All of this is still pending. And we should also know that the education sectors in the various countries should be involved, so that the content of secondary school curricula, for example, include education to prevent adolescent pregnancies, which are of such concern to parents. It would be extremely interesting also to focus on the UNFPA's multidimensional work, technical advice, and its support to states, to allow us in all countries to have a national intercultural health system, not only as pilot projects, but...
Make your closing remarks, please.
Yeah. Eso es todo.
Thank you very much.
So much, Tasila. We do appreciate your remarks. I'm going to have to turn the microphone over to our esteemed executive director. She is going to make her closing remarks. Thank you so much.
First of all, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'd like to apologize to the delegates that we were not, and to my colleagues who are stand ready to answer your questions, that we couldn't take all of them. The dialogue has obviously been very rewarding and a unique experience for all of us, because in the past several years, UNFPA has been working closely with the Permanent Forum, which gives us an opportunity to present our work with indigenous peoples. But this dialogue represents a turning point in our collaboration, because for the first time, we are challenged to review our work
and to ask ourselves how we can respond better to your needs. When we prepared the written report for this forum, we focused on capturing our country office experiences, recognizing the importance of systematizing the lessons learned over 10 years of work, including not just successes, but also our mistakes and our challenges. We think that this systematization will allow us to devise knowledge assets and a global strategy for providing more coherent responses to Indigenous peoples' issues around the world, even in countries where MDGs are likely to be attained by 2015. As was mentioned by my colleagues earlier, national indicators often hide huge disparities among different groups of the population. And we are very much cognizant that Indigenous peoples and ethnic minorities around the world systematically appear among these groups that are lagging behind in the achievement of the MDGs. We'd therefore like to commit to renew our efforts to address these challenges, to bring them to the forefront, and to expand a more meaningful, culturally pertinent participation of Indigenous peoples in development processes. Nothing about you without you is what we implicitly believe in our planning process. May I conclude by thanking especially the chairperson and the members of the forum, as well as all the people, the delegates and NGO representatives who have engaged actively today in a constructive and positive dialogue. Please be assured that we will share your suggestions and recommendations with our regional and country offices and be vigilant that they are taken into account in their planning of work. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Madame Manet. I am going to turn over the floor to my esteemed colleague, Pemene, for some closing remarks. Pemene? Her microphone is not on. It is now on.
Yes, it is on. Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the floor one more time. On behalf of the members of the Permanent Forum, I'd like to extend my sincere gratitude for all the honorable people from UNFPA's informative presentations. It was truly an honor for Permanent Forum to be able to have this fruitful dialogue with respected authorities of UNFPA. Permanent Forum looks forward to working with UNFPA at a national, regional, as well as global levels throughout its comprehensive programs. We really hope that the issue of Indigenous people in the programs of UNFPA to be as much mainstreamed as possible in the very near future so that we could see more feasible results and everything here in our next session. Thank you again for all your very informative remarks. Thank you.
Ms. Lillian, my colleague and our next speaker. Ms. Lillian, do you have the floor?
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to thank UNFPA. I can read the mission statement, which says that the fund assists countries by using population data to establish policies and programs to reduce poverty and to ensure that every pregnancy is desired, that every delivery is without risk, and that every person is free from HIV/AIDS, and that women are treated with dignity and respect. I admire this mission statement, but I can assess the challenges that lie outside this statement for the staff working in the field or in offices. I personally have been able to see that these are major challenges and obstacles But a lot of goodwill has been able to overcome them. And I think that at the next session, our dialogue will be even more fruitful. Thank you.
Here is my colleague, Elise Kanki, who will make some closing remarks. Madam Kiki.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
In the report submitted by UNFPA, we speak about support to the achievement of the MDGs. However, indigenous peoples, in many of these reports, I would say in most of them, are not really addressed specifically. And you yourselves have explained some of the barriers. For example, the fact that that they are not fully taken into account in the data systems of education and health sectors, which cannot include parameters which can give us specifically what is happening in indigenous communities. I would suggest that an effort be undertaken, that we begin to work on this, because this is beginning to sound like repeated excuses that we have heard in public administration and the Confederation working at the community level or in local government. And I think that the time has come for us to take decisions and to begin to take risks. I think that with practical cases in which we can learn methodology and show that there is no need for so many resources, which we're always talking about, because, in fact, the information yielded by a health services in communities include a wealth of statistics which only include two or three parameters in terms of indigenous peoples for education and health. And I think that that is no longer a justification. The second issue I would like to stress is that of census. With great concern, we have heard that especially in Latin America, some countries are going to skirt questions to identify the indigenous population. And this decision is of concern. We are taking very risky steps backward. And I would suggest to UNFPA that it not be a part of this. I think that you can help us ensure that these countries rescind those decisions and incorporate these questions again in their in the census questionnaires for 2010. Thank you.
I would like to thank my distinguished colleagues of the Permanent Forum for their excellent questions and participation today. And also, please extend, and all of us, please extend our gratitude to the representatives of UNFPA, and through you and on behalf of the members here, the delegates, and all of us at the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues at the 8th session. Madame Manet, please accept our sincere thank you for a very rewarding and, as you say, unique experience for this dialogue and furthering of partnership and collaboration between the Permanent Forum and UN agencies, and in particular, your agency. Thank you for bringing your team and your excellent team here to be with us today. Please extend our thank you. And please extend our thank yous to our interpreters for staying a few extra minutes and for being so patient. I am, but to the Youth Caucus, to the Asian Caucus, I am handing over the question of the Youth Caucus to our agency representative, and the Asian Caucus can bring your statement up and give it to the representative. We have run out of time, so please. And the secretariat does have a short announcement. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Right after this meeting, the permanent forum will meet with the interagency support group on indigenous issues in a small alphabet room B. Thank you.